This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, this is Kelvin Yee and you're tuned in to the Evening Edition. Now, on a global level, we've seen progress in women's employment through the years. However, women continue to be underrepresented in the workforce compared to men, especially in leadership roles. How much are we losing out when women don't participate in the workforce? And how should organizations adjust themselves to accommodate more female employees? So one of the pressing challenges identified by the World Economic Forum this year is the need to work towards gender parity. Last month, I attended the World Economic Forum on ASEAN 2016, which was held on our soils. I caught a moment with Sadia Zahidi. She's the head of employment and gender initiatives at the World Economic Forum. Sadia talks to us about womenomics. She explains our current concerns and challenges in female employment and the direction we should all be heading in.
So womenomics is essentially a new field that has emerged that looks at women's integration into the labor force and what that does in terms of returns to the economy, what that does in terms of returns to businesses, why that is a strategy that governments and businesses should be pursuing.
What kind of policy are we talking about?
So this is, the person who came up with the concept is Kathy Matsui at Goldman Sachs, and she was looking at the situation in Japan. And this also ties to demographics, right? So if you have an aging economy and you have more than half of the people that are coming out of universities are female, but then you look at the entry-level ranks, the middle management ranks, and the very top ranks of businesses, and you see this lack of women particularly dropping off throughout the hierarchies of companies, there is something broken with the talent system, and that's a loss of the enormous talent and potential of these women, and a loss to the potential bottom line of those companies, and a loss overall to those economies. So the policies that deal with this are multiple because it's an issue that exists across the economy, across different industries.
So we've seen in some countries and even here in Malaysia that there are more women graduates than men graduates. Why doesn't that translate to more women in leadership positions?
Very often, organizations are designed for family structures that actually don't exist anymore, and they're designed for the business world of 30, 40, even 50 years ago, and they haven't necessarily gone through change. And so you can end up having fairly rigid policies inside companies that are not taking into account through a gender lens what recruitment and retaining and promotions need to look like. So that's one aspect. It's not necessarily overt discrimination always. It's really just that is how structures have been designed, and they have been designed for a model where men are the breadwinner for their families and women are seen as occupying a role as potentially a second role within a family and as something that will always take a back seat to their family preferences. And a lot of these preferences have changed, particularly for the millennial generation. And I think that's the change we're seeing today because a lot of the people that are coming into the workforce now, both women and men, are looking for ways to balance their work life and their family life. Yet organizations are still designed for a time where they are expecting that neither men nor women are holding those kinds of ideals. So that's a lot of the change that needs to happen.
Why do you think that this catch-up is not happening more quickly?
I think some of the catch-up, lack of catch-up, is because the talent case is not yet clear. Not all companies have internalized the fact that women are the majority of those that are coming out of universities in over 100 countries in the world, including Malaysia. So that hasn't been internalized. Your base talent level, of course, it depends on which industry it is. So in certain industries, there is a lack of female talent that's coming through the pipeline of education. But in many others, it's the reverse. It's the majority of the talent that's coming in. But overall in the country, the majority of the high-skilled talent is incredibly female. Part of it is that, not having internalized what the base of talent looks like. A second piece is this issue of just simply time lag, because massive organizations of thousands of people have been built up with this specific kind of structure, and it takes a lot of energy and effort to change those structures so that they're designed more for today. And then a third piece is actually not recognizing the value of diversity. So the term that's often used is a diversity dividend. So in a lot of complex decision making, it is best to have heard out many points of view. Now, that the diversity may not necessarily be a good thing on a factory floor with a lot of repetitive processes, but diversity is a very good thing as we enter a more complex and interconnected world. And so given how much the labor force has changed, given how much the business models have changed, the value of diversity will only increase. And so there has to be a recognition that teams make better decisions if they're more diverse. Teams undertake much better risk analysis when they have both women and men involved. So there has to be much more recognition of that too.
What do we lose out on if there aren't enough women in the workforce?
Well, certainly one thing we lose out on is the capacity of families to be able to earn a living that they can then invest in the next generation and have a productive life. You know, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, you could have families that lived on a single income. That is actually not possible anymore, particularly not in most urban areas. You actually do need dual-income families. And so one aspect is simply that. We're making it much harder for families to be able to live their life as they want to be able to consume as they want to, and to be able to invest in the next generation as they want to. So that's one aspect. A second is, of course, just quite simply for those individuals that have trained for certain professions, women who have trained for certain professions, who have the skill set, are unable to realize their full potential. So their own particular talent is wasted. And then, of course, overall, there's a lot of data that shows that countries that have more women in the workforce perform much better economically. They have higher growth rates. They have more inclusive economies in the long term. And so countries overall lose out as well.
So the common idea used to be that millennials should adapt to traditional work practices once they hit the workforce, but that didn't seem to work. So it seems that workplaces instead need to adjust to accommodate the new generation of workers. But are these changes happening quickly enough?
So, you know, it's an interesting point that you say, yes, I think about 5 years ago, a lot of the conversation about millennials was simply millennials need to be brought into line with how things get done, right? And now it's changed to recognition that, millennials are now going to be the largest cohort in the workforce. And so, in fact, it might be organizations that need to change. So I think some of it is simply about letting that change happen. Some of it is simply the fact that now that there's a recognition that this is one of the largest cohorts in the workforce, and it's only going to get bigger, as more and more people graduate university from that cohort and come into the workforce, there are also people, the older end of this cohort is now in middle management roles, for example. So they themselves are making different choices about their own staff members, and they're also making different choices about themselves. So they are choosing in a certain way how much time to invest in work, how much time to invest in family, how many times they want to change their careers. So I think some of it is organic. The change will happen because they're now in place. And some of it is also just recognition by governments that regardless of which cohort is in the workplace, there is a potential loss if women are not integrated. And so there is a lot more effort by certain governments to either put in place affirmative policies for getting more women into senior levels of business, or there's a lot more effort to design a better, more efficient, what is called a care economy, which is essentially childcare, elder care systems.
That's Sadia Zahidi. She's the head of employment and gender initiatives at the World Economic Forum. In a while, we'll be talking about the idea of having quotas for women participation in the workforce. Stay tuned. This is Kelvin Yee on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bruce Freddie Morrissey, BFM 89.9.
This is Kelvin Yee. You're listening to the Evening Edition. Today, we're talking about womenomics, or women's participation in the workforce. Last month at the World Economic Forum on ASEAN 2016, I met up with Sadia Zahidi. She's the head of employment and gender initiatives and member of the executive committee at World Economic Forum. Sadia and I discuss about womenomics, or women's employment in our world today. Some people are against the idea of having quotas for women participation. How effective are quotas?
So quotas are very effective because, of course, they're mandated from the top, right? So if you simply make it the law, then of course they lead to change. But are they effective in changing mindsets, I think, is really the question. And I think it depends very much on how they're implemented. If they are implemented as you said, arbitrarily, or as a sort of very blunt measure, they are unlikely to be incredibly effective because they're seen as an imposition and they're seen as not necessarily getting all the right talented people in place. If they are implemented in a way where it is, for example, there's a clear time lag, so it's not one day to the next, where there's a clear recognition that in order to put this quota in place, we need 3 to 5 years, for example, to make it happen. A 3 to 5 year deadline, for example, for a quota for women on boards gives plenty of time to companies to seek out that talent, and in cases where they don't necessarily find the talent, to train that talent. So that's one aspect to take into account, put the time in place. A second aspect to take into account is a quota does not always have to be on the outcome. So, for example, a quota does not have to be on the final positions in Parliament, for example. The quota can be on the candidate lists. So, similarly, for interviews, you do not necessarily have to put a quota on the position must absolutely be held by a woman, but you can insist that the candidate pools that are interviewed are 50-50, are balanced, for example. So there are ways to put in place quotas that are on the talent pool rather than on the outcome, and that also has an effect in the long term. So, for example, in Denmark, they put in place political party candidate quotas of 50-50, and they actually removed those quotas a few years later because they didn't need them anymore, because that actually became a natural process to have that 50-50, and it resulted in 50-50 outcomes as well over time, not immediately, but over time. And then maybe a last piece related to quotas is sometimes it does not actually have to be the quota itself. It can be sort of the threat of a quota that ends up working too. And so, for example, in the UK, the publicly listed companies on the FTSE, they had, I think, only 14% women directors, women board on boards of directors, and the threat of the quota was that if we haven't managed to get this to 25% in 5 years' time, we're going to put in place a quota. And, you know, of course, they got to the 25%. So it's also possible, I think, to use different kinds of measures that are more sophisticated than the traditional view of quotas being very blunt. And then finally, one last piece on quotas is, I'm not sure if you necessarily need to call it a quota, but there can also be targets around gender equal cabinets, for example, cabinets and ministries. And this is something that Michelle Bachelet, the president of Chile, the first time that she was in government, she said, well, in my 16-person cabinet, of course I can have 8 of those people be female. Are you telling me that it's not possible to find 8 women in all of Chile who could occupy that position? So there's also just a piece of this which is about recognizing, are we talking about quotas for thousands and thousands of people and there isn't a talent pool, or are we talking about quotas for very specific positions for which actually there are a lot of very highly qualified people? So there's many different ways to look at it. It depends on the quota on the issue that the quota is trying to affect.
Right now, we're on the topic of women and political participation. So you also did a report called the Global Gender Gap Report, which you co-authored. Rwanda's an interesting case. Can you talk about Rwanda?
Sure. So Rwanda actually entered the rankings only a couple of years ago in the Global Gender Gap Report. And the methodology of the report is such that we are not looking at the overall levels of income or the overall level of development of any country. We are looking at the relative gap between women and men, regardless of what we're talking about, whether it's health or education or political empowerment, or economic participation. So certainly the report is not suggesting that the level of health of women in Rwanda is higher, for example, than the level of health in the United Kingdom for women. But what we are doing is looking at the gaps between women and men. And because Rwanda has actually the highest number of women in parliament, and because it has an incredibly female workforce, because of that, it ends up doing extremely well. And I think the last rankings, it was number 6 out of the 145 countries that we covered. So it's the highest ranking sub-Saharan African country, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that women have taken a lot of the roles in the workforce, and women have taken a lot of the roles in politics. And some of it is because of the tragic past of the country from 20 years ago, but some of it is very conscious policies that have been created to ensure that women are now at the forefront of society.
Saudi Arabia is viewed as the backwater of female rights. Because you found, I think, if I'm not mistaken, in the report you found that Saudi Arabia was actually one of the fastest moving, has one of the fastest movements in terms of women empowerment.
Yeah. So Saudi Arabia is the biggest mover on the economic participation of women. So we look at 4 different areas in the index: education, health, politics, and economic participation. And it is the highest relative mover. So, of course, it's starting from a very low base, but it has the biggest percentage increase out of any other country in the world in the last 10 years, because we now have 10 years worth of data. And this is not surprising, because there are a lot of efforts underway to try to get more women into the workforce, and those efforts are possible because there has already been about 20 to 30 years of investment of getting women into university. So it's not just about completing school, it is also about getting more women into university. And considering where the country was back in, for example, 1970, this is a huge change for the country. So In less than half a century, there have been huge changes in terms of education, and what is underway now is more of an integration into the workforce. Now, that's not to say that there aren't still huge barriers left. There are, but part of the research that I've been doing for my book is looking at how many more women have entered the labor force in the last 10 years alone. And this is not a number for Saudi Arabia, but for all of the Arab world, it's 9 million more women that have entered the workforce in the last 10 years. And in total across the Muslim world, it's 40 million more women. So a lot of that change has actually come from the Arab world, even though, of course, the population is much smaller than other parts of the Muslim world. So relatively speaking, there has been a lot of change there.
You just heard from Sadia Zahidi. She's the head of employment and gender initiatives at the World Economic Forum. After the news, we'll discuss how the Muslim world is adapting to the demands of womenomics. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Building fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
Hello, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. If you've just joined us, today we're discussing womenomics, or women participation in the workforce. The World Economic Forum on ASEAN 2016 was held in Malaysia last month. I caught up with Sadia Zahidi. She's the head of employment and gender initiatives at the World Economic Forum. We talked about how womenomics is shaping workplaces in the Muslim world. You were talking about how there has been a huge increase in the number of working women in the Muslim world. How do businesses in the Muslim world adapt to this? For example, in a separate interview, you mentioned that in some Muslim nations, there are separate floors in offices for workers of different genders.
So it depends on which country it is. So, of course, in a country like Saudi Arabia, where there are quite a lot of restrictions, or there's a lot of specific rules to which companies have to be compliant. They have to apply for special permits if they want to have floors in which there are both women and men working together. They have to, otherwise there does have to be segregation in terms of floors. They've used technology to some extent. So, for example, people are part of the same team and they will talk by video conference as opposed to being on the same floor. In other cases, they apply for the permits. It's complicated, but they apply for the permits and they create mixed floors. In a lot of so I've been inside quite a few of these offices, and I think in some cases It's extremely sort of, men and women are working together, and it's a very professional environment. It looks like any office in any other part of the world. And in other places, you really do have completely separate entrances. You do have very separate ways of being able to work. So I think there are a few of these extra hoops that some of these companies need to go through, and a lot of the Western companies that are present in these environments are I think particularly sort of diligent on making sure that they are complying with all of the requirements. But almost everybody that I have interviewed has said it is absolutely worth it. Yes, it is a slightly more expensive investment. Yes, it is a little bit more paperwork. Yes, it's a little bit more expensive, a little bit less convenient, but it pays off because they can see already the value of diversity. And they see that in two ways. One, they feel that their teams work better when they are of mixed genders. And two, they often find that because these women have received an opportunity for the first time, not just in their lives, but also actually in generations in their families, it's the first time that there is a woman who's working outside the home, they're very much wanting to prove themselves, they're very dedicated to their careers, they find ways to balance work and family, and that they are one of the best workers that they end up having. And this is a comment that I kept receiving from people. So it shouldn't have to be that women have to outprove themselves in order to be part of the workforce, but certainly in this period of change in Saudi Arabia in particular, this is happening. In many other countries, it depends, again, on what the situation is. So, for example, in Pakistan, where I come from, there are definitely social norms that prevent mingling of women and men in certain circumstances, but there are no laws against it. And so there it's about developing a cultural sensitivity as to how companies handle whether women receive specific kinds of transport that is for them, that picks them up from their home, drops them back. The transport has a security guard on board to ensure that parents or husbands, for example, of those women feel safe, that their wives or their daughters are able to be transported safely. But that is more about cultural sensitivity rather than something that is mandated by the government. So it really depends on which part of the world it is. And of course, in a country like this one, I don't particularly see any restrictions of that nature at all.
So how is Womenomics doing in the Muslim world?
There's a lot of change underway. I think there are very positive trends underway. There are, in the last 10 years, there are millions more women that have come into the workforce than there were in the 10 years before that, or in the 20 or 30 years before that. In fact, out of all the women that are working in the Muslim world, one third of them have come into the workforce only in the last 10 years. So there's massive change underway. But as we were talking earlier, the catch-up has to happen by organizations and the catch-up has to happen by policymakers, because policies and business practices are still designed for a very different world. And so that adjustment and how fast it happens is going to be the true test, because if those adjustments don't happen, then there is a danger that a lot of these women that are coming into the workforce for the first time will end up having the same sort of fate as a lot of the women in, for example, the United States, with the early influx of women into the workforce, when they didn't find the changes in policies, when they didn't find the supporting infrastructure that was needed, many of them ended up having to make choices between work and home or having to reduce how much they worked. And that's, of course, detrimental to those economies. So the real test will be how quickly businesses and governments adjust.
What are the big challenges coming? Because you also co-authored another report, which is called The Future of Work. And
wow, you have really read up on all our stuff. That's great.
You got to get it prepared. So in that report, you looked at the fourth industrial revolution. Could you briefly tell us about that?
Sure. So the fourth industrial revolution is a term coined by the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, and what it really is the there have been industrial revolutions before, certainly. And I think the latest one that we have seen is the internet and mobile technology. But what's happening today is you've got 3D printing interacting with mobile technology, interacting with the Internet of Things, interacting with whole new fields in biology, for example. So you've got the lines between different sectors have disappeared. And so you've got lots of different sectors interacting with each other, and the spread of technology across different sectors, including very traditional ones like agriculture, has completely transformed how those business models function, but also then how do people work within those particular industries. Because of that changing work, there's probably a couple of gender implications as well. Because of that high technology focus and the high degree of comfort with technology that is required in almost all fields, there's two factors pertaining to women that might have an impact. One, women have less access to the internet than men do globally. It depends on where you are in the world. In some parts of the world, women are actually the highest users of social media, but in a lot of places in the world, even if their usage is higher, the percentage of women that have access is lower than the percentage of men that have access. So one aspect is going to be that. Are women going to have the awareness and the long-term practical use that is going to be a part of how they're going to do business, how they're going to do work? And a second piece is women don't go into STEM and IT fields in as many numbers as men do in most of the world. Again, this depends. In some places in the world, it's nearly equal. It's a fairly Western problem, but it's also exists in many countries in the Muslim world too. And so if the IT sector is going to be one of the sectors that grows the most, or if very STEM-related fields within agriculture or within healthcare or within, manufacturing are the ones that are going to be growing, if those are the professions that are going to be growing, and if women make up only 30% of the graduates in those fields, well, then we're going to see a growing gender gap as well. So that's one big aspect. The second aspect is much more positive, and that is the other field, or rather not field, but the skill set that is going to grow is collaboration and creativity and how people work together. These are uniquely human traits. They are not going to get automated. They are not traits that are going to get replaced by machines. And in fact, the need for collaboration is only going to grow. Now, there's definitely some controversy around this, but it is most anecdotal evidence suggests that women are better at collaboration than men are. Now, this could simply be because of history and because of how they have always been the non-dominant group, and so to get some form of influence, they've always had to collaborate. So no one says that this is a trait that every individual woman holds. This is just an anecdotal evidence that managers see when they see their teams collaborating, for example. Will it last into the future? We also don't know that. So once women have that same level of influence and power, would those kind of behaviors continue or not? We don't know it. But definitely women are very well poised to create the kind of collaboration that's going to be valued in the future. So I think that's one other piece. And maybe a third is actually very unrelated to the fourth industrial revolution, but is a big part of the demographic change that is taking place. And that is the need for the care professions to grow. So as we go towards this technological future, as well as the demographic changes that are happening today, there's going to be a much greater need for childcare and elder care, certainly, but there's also going to be a much greater need for example, therapists and coaches and trainers and people who are doing, again, very uniquely human roles. And those are all areas in which women are the majority of the workforce today. So that actually might create an opportunity as those sectors become less fragmented, as those sectors become more commercialized, as those sectors lead to much greater opportunity than they did in the past. That might be an area that women might be able to grow their impact in the economy rather than lose out.
In a while, Sadia will be talking to us about the future of womenomics. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Business, finance, and music. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Kelvin Yee. Now, we're going to continue our discussion with Saadia Zahidi. She's the head of employment and gender initiatives at the World Economic Forum. We're talking about the future of womenomics, or women's participation in the global workforce. We simply do not see enough women participation in STEM fields. So, is the fourth industrial revolution a threat or a boon to womenomics?
You know, it's interesting, a lot of predictions say there's going to be this many job losses, and then there's a lot of predictions that say there are going to be this many job gains. And I think in the end, actually, none of it holds true unless we take some actions today. So if we take no actions and we don't attempt to retrain people, so this is not even STEM fields, but people who are going to lose their jobs today, if we don't attempt to retrain them and create new ways for them to be able to earn a living, to be able to support their families, if we don't do anything about that today, then yes, we will end up in scenario one, which is job losses. And if we do succeed in doing that, and if we do succeed in retraining, and not just retraining those that, for example, are not in STEM fields, are not going to go into STEM fields, but can find other opportunities in other ways, and at the same time, if we also send more people towards STEM fields, IT fields, fields that are more creative, et cetera, if we do do that, then we will end up in the second scenario, which is having a lot more roles, a lot more jobs, a lot more opportunities, and for people to be able to fulfill their full potential. So I think, frankly, I could tell you many predictions, but none of those predictions really hold true unless we take some actions today. And we actually have a very unique window of opportunity now, because the full impact of the fourth industrial revolution has not yet hit us. And so it really depends on the actions we take today. I think if we wait another 5 years, we're going to end up in scenario one.
We've seen many gains in terms of women empowerment. Do you see any threat to this development?
I think the threats are what we just discussed. It's potentially the fact that the fourth industrial revolution is causing huge changes to labor markets, and in the concern that, for example, governments are feeling about what's going to happen when they have much higher numbers of people unemployed, or how are they going to make the right kinds of investments in education systems to prepare people for the future, or how are they going to create the right kind of adult training and reskilling programs. As they think about that, if they don't put on a gender lens, I think then that's one potential threat. So while it's a lot to ask, one of the things that needs to happen is ensuring that all the policies related to labor, education, and social protection have a very clear gender lens. So that's one very important thing. But at the same time, I think there's also a lot of opportunity. Because women are the majority of those that are coming out of university for a good 10 years now, I think there's a lot of opportunity. They are set up to sort of ensure that they get themselves retrained, that they get themselves more opportunities in the workforce. And so I think there's also just a changing mindset that is inspiring women to reach out for more. And that's also, of course, you know, global communications and the fact that you can be sitting in a small town in the south of Punjab, and you can look at, I don't know, Sheryl Sandberg's talk on Leaning In. That means that while everybody may not agree with all of that, it certainly means that information is traveling across the world and people are able to make much more informed decisions. And so the level of aspiration I have seen in young women across the Muslim world is huge. So I think that's going to be a very positive factor.
I think just finally, Kathy Matsui, she had this great quote during her TED Talk, which was, "There for women, there isn't a glass ceiling, but there's just a ceiling full of men that you need to break through."
Yeah, there's another one of the forum's close constituents, Laura Liswood, she puts it slightly differently. She says, there's no such thing as a glass ceiling, it's just a thick layer of men. And that might be very true, but I think, you know, as I said before, I think it is less, more and more, there's less overt discrimination at the top. I mean, there's certainly a generation that still believes that women should be in a certain role and men should be in a certain role. But more and more, it is less about overt discrimination. It's about implicit biases. It's about what people are believing without recognizing that that's what they believe. And so they take decisions which are having these negative impacts, but they don't realize that they are doing that kind of discrimination. Or it's because organizational structures and systems have stayed stuck in the past. So I think if there's a more conscious effort towards these changes, we will hopefully see much more positive change to come.
Sadia, Sahidi, thank you so much for speaking to me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was my conversation with Sadia Zahidi. She is the head of employment and gender initiatives and member of the executive committee at the World Economic Forum. If you've missed any part of this interview, you can head over to our website at bfm.my to download the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. This is Kelvin Yee on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.